His guests are a little bit late, so I'm going to play a couple of extra songs just to get get through that gap. After that, Robin with Ink Studs and Marie-Ève with the French Connection. So lots of fantastic stuff here on CITR. Please stay tuned all afternoon. If you like what you heard, who knows? You can check out the podcast at CITR.ca or go to duncansonuts.wordpress.com to find out what was played. I'm going to close out. I'm going to play some New Pornographers in a bit. They have a new album out called Together, and it's a genuinely catchy. I know they don't really need... They played Jimmy Fallon last night. I know they don't really need CITR airtime, but now that I have it, a little extra time, I'll play a song by them. And but before that, some Gories. They're getting back together. They got back together last summer, and they're going to get back together to play some shows in New York. So we're going to hear the song Sister Anne from their album, I Know You Be House Rockin'. Here we go. Thanks for listening. I'll be a lot more chill next week. Promise. Here we go.
Sister Anne, pray for me, cause I need it desperately. I'll give you the goddamn money, cause nobody else can see. I need someone to pray for me. My mom says it shouldn't give me nothing. She says it's nothing but a fuck. She says it shouldn't give nobody money. Just to mention your name to God. But I need it desperately. I need an intermediary. I need someone to pray for me.
You listen to We All Fall Down on 101.9 CITR. Today I have a very, very special, beautiful guest, Kate and Melissa. Movie No Fun City.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Cool.
Yeah.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for coming.
And
thank
for
you so much.
Compliments.
No problem. I say what I see. Okay, so the last week Kate, you already were on the Kaba Radio.
Yeah.
And so probably if someone missed it or like didn't have a chance to listen, could you please tell us about the movie and what it's about and like.
Sure. So No Fun City is a feature-length documentary about music in Vancouver and the struggles that musicians and venue owners face here, about basically generally keeping art culture alive in the fight to do so in your city.
Yeah, and I guess it follows, so we have characters in our film that we followed for about a year and a half, and I guess they all kind of approach the problem of having a music venue or trying to find a music venue in a different way. So we kind of tell the story through our awesome cast. So Malice Livett from The Sweatshop, who was a venue owner, an illegitimate venue, who ends up losing his venue, and we watch him try in the beginning to do everything the city expected of him, and when that fails, you know, he has to find somewhere else, and that's kind of his plight. Wendy 13, who's the manager of the Cobalt, who, you know, comes across as this awesome punk rock mom who just wants to help everyone and get the kids to come out to shows. And, she, you know, she's such a powerful woman in the community like that. And then we kind of watch as her life takes a turn when, you know, not everything works out as she's planned, and she ends up, you know, as anyone in Vancouver knows, losing the Cobalt. And so we follow that. And then there's the... there's David Dupree, who, as we all know, has opened the Rickshaw Theater, who presents kind of a more administrative, or, you know, maybe the way City Hall would like things to be. So he kind of has a different approach to it, although equally as frustrated. It just shows a different angle. If you do want to do things completely legitimately and really above board, it's still complicated, and it's, you still get entangled in this kind of bureaucratic mess, which is what happens to him. And then we've got an exploration of the DIY scene, which is people that have just said, you know what, we don't need this. It's just too much hassle, and we can just have a show, get our bands to play, get our friends to come out and have an equally as great time. Until, of course, the cops shut it down. Yeah. So that's where the problem comes in for them.
So you show, like, the Vancouver music scene from all different types of angles?
Yeah, or the struggle maybe that they're all having and how they react to it, or, yeah. And also, because of that, we get to present all these different types of underground music that are awesome and flourishing in the city. So because we have all these different kind of storylines, we get to see different styles and different trends of music in the city, which is kind of, yeah, one thing we were really stoked about. It brings all of it together in this big kind of, you know, awesome underground film that we're proud of.
I think you're doing a great job, because, like, I didn't like the fact that Cobalt was closed too, but I sat down at home and did nothing. You actually did a movie, and you, like, raised the awareness. Have you ever heard about this movie's the similar idea? Like, about, you know, like, the problems for a music CD, for the artists, for the people to put up the shows, or, like, something like that. I personally just saw only one movie. It was about the Gilman, the club in California, but it was more like a documentary about the actual venue.
Oh, okay.
But
yeah, I think there was a documentary, I think, or, you know, maybe a short done about CBGBs, because, I mean, that had a huge impact on...
But it's only the venue.
Yeah, like the one venue.
Not the whole...
No. And there's been documentaries kind of about scenes. There's that one, We Fun Atlanta, which is more about, I guess, the opposite.
Yeah.
It's about how all these great bands are, you know, supported and having an awesome time in Atlanta. But no, and I think that's when I started kind of coming up with this idea. A lot of people were like, that's actually not been explored, really. Like, the side of a scene that we don't see, which is, yeah, someone has to put on these shows. And I think it's a voice that's really probably never been heard that much. And it was cool because... really, when it comes down to it, there's all these great bands and there's all these fans and people that want to come out, but you never really think about what Wendy has to do in order to make that happen.
And you don't think about, you know, when she loses the Cobalt, she loses everything in her life.
Yeah.
And you don't normally think about the detrimental effects it has on someone. You know, you just think of the venue closing, but you don't think of all the love and the passion that goes behind it.
Yeah, and people will be like, oh, well, there'll be another place to play.
Yeah.
Well, there won't be another Cobalt for Wendy. And like, oh, well, the Cobalt's still there.
And
it's not the same place, and it never will be. And the city will, you know, sign a piece of paper not thinking like, okay, well, what does that do to the life of the person, or the life of Malice Livid, or the life of Wendy?
And to a community, too.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? So
yeah, and then where do people go? It's like kind of a displacement. But I think, yeah, there definitely is an apathy as well. Just like, oh, well, we'll have another space and we can find somewhere else. But I mean, they're getting slimmer and slimmer. And is that really the point? Like, do we need to keep chasing the next spot? It's frustrating. Wendy's frustrated, and she'd love to find a place. She'd love to probably still be at the Cobalt, you know?
So the movie premiere is in Vancouver on May 10th, 2010, as the part of the Doxa Film Festival.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Could you please tell a couple of words about this festival? How did you get a chance to get a spot there?
Well, we should add that there's an additional screening.
Yeah.
The screening on the 10th sold out, so they've added an additional screening on Sunday, May 16th, and you can get tickets online at Doxa.
I don't think there's any left.
I think there's like 15 left.
Yeah.
So get them quick. Off. Yeah.
Doxa. Doxa is a really interesting festival, and I think in a sense, you know, they took a risk on us, and we're really happy because at one point, I mean, this film is such a struggle to get made. We didn't have, you know, any support or backing in the early days at all. So, and we kind of, you know, it is, it is kind of edgy, and it is, you know, what did they put it? A slice of outlaw culture. Yes. I mean, yeah, there are people doing things in this film that, you know, maybe some people don't understand, or, you know, are breaking certain laws or whatever. So we were kind of, we were really happy that Doxa took the film on, because it gives us as filmmakers a kind of credibility, but it also lets other people who might have dismissed the film as purely an underground thing for, you know, people mm-hmm. that are already prone to caring, like, it opens it up to this wider audience. So that's really cool. And I think if you look at the selection of films at Doxa, I mean, all of them kind of have a meaning and some kind of passion behind them, and I think they're really kind of trying to open people's eyes to other people's realities. I don't know. But yeah, I don't know. Like, what can you add to that, Katie Kroll?
It's a good documentary film festival, and they always bring in, you know, really great docs. So we're proud to be a part of it.
And they approached us. They mm-hmm. they wanted
to.
So
they actually
yeah, found. They were interested in the idea of the film, and they were interested in us as young filmmakers, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. they approached us, and kind of every once in a while would check in and be like, hey, how's it going with the film? Which, you know, we thought was really nice of them, and uh-huh. when we finally finished it on time, just yeah. barely for the festival, we were just, you know, we just couldn't be happier.
Okay, so if you have any questions for Kate and Lisa, you can call us at 604-822-2487, or you can email us at weallfalldown@citr@gmail.com, and I have this email opened right now, so we can have some online talking or something. Let's play some music. Today I decided to play only local bands. The local bands, yay. Some of them are in the movie. I like all those bands, and I chose like all my favorite ones, and I want to show people. So yeah, there are lots of really great bands, and they need to have a chance to play some rock and roll music. Okay, let's listen some rock and roll.
Oh, all over Britain, signs like this flash their nightly invitation. And in response, more than 500,000 people go dancing every week, all the year round.
Hey, Scott T. Scenic Drive has been on the air for 15 years.
And to celebrate, I'm having
screenings of Dance Craze and The Liberty of Norton Folgate.
Beneath the neon lights, youth resolves its differences. It's an offbeat, toe-tapping sound, a rhythm for their feet that takes high-spirited youngsters off the streets and into a music that speaks to them. It's been called ska. It's even been called blue beat and rocksteady.
Thursday, May 6th at 121 Studios.
But when these bands start swinging, our young people are in total agreement. The only word for it is fun.
It's Scott T. Scenic Drive's 15-year anniversary flick night. Come on down.
One, two!
Hello, you're listening to We All Fall Down on 101.9 CHR. Today
we all fell down, I think.
Yeah.
I'm on the floor right now.
Sorry. I have Melissa and Kate, the creators of the amazing movie No Fun City, which is a huge deal for our city. And you can see because the tickets are sold out already for the first screening. You mentioned that you are young filmmakers. And could you please tell how is it tough to produce a DIY documentary in today's film business?
I don't think it's as tough as it. It's tough, don't get me wrong. But I think we have a lot of advantages now, especially with accessible cameras, you know, and programs like Final Cut Pro. Mm-hmm. It's a lot easier to do DIY. Not to say that it was easy making this film at all.
Yeah, the thing to realize, when we started off, we tried to, get a broadcaster on board or, you know, all these things we look back at and we were like, why did we even bother? It was really hard and pretty much, you know, we got laughed out of people's offices. The thing is, too, is like the subject matter of the film is something that is under supported and underfunded. And so, you know, a film about that is not going to have much luck either. So it was difficult. And I think had we just kind of taken people's advice in those early days, we wouldn't have pursued and we wouldn't have made the film. But what happened is, you know, we stuck to it. And it takes determination and it takes, you know, not taking a day off ever. It takes working, you know, 16 hours a day. It takes bugging people, trying to get into places. Yeah, persistence. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you wonder why you're doing it and you're like, why am I ever going to finish this film? But you reach this point where it becomes bigger than you. And we were so lucky that other people came on board and a production company, Make Believe Media, helped us so much, and other people volunteered on the project, and, you know, we made a feature film for, what, $20,000?
Yeah, we started
DIY.
Yeah. We started with a camcorder and a karaoke mic, and then luckily when Lynn Booth, the president and executive producer of Make Believe Media, she found out about our film, and she really liked what we were doing, and she really liked our passion, and she wanted to support young women filmmakers, and so...
And not a lot of people do. So she as well took a risk, and like a lot of people have taken a risk on us, and you know, we really respect that. Like, we would be nothing without, you know, having the guidance of other people.
Yeah,
our original project wouldn't have been as, you know, it wouldn't have, I don't think it would have reached as many people, and that's what's cool about this. But I would still say, like, if you're dedicated and you want to make a film and you're passionate about your subject matter, don't let anyone tell you that you can't make
it. Just keep making it and just go out and shoot it.
You'll look for funding on websites and you're going to go through so much paperwork and you're not going to be eligible for, you know, maybe 1% of it you'll be eligible for. That shouldn't detract you from doing what you really want to do, which is go out there with your camera, with your bad microphone. Like, you know, the audio isn't amazing in our film, but that's the film. That's what it is. It's DIY. And if you really care, then you can get that project made. Someone will see it. And it's not even about who sees it. It's about you experiencing making that film. And as a filmmaker, that should be your most important, like, that's the most important thing. The experience of it, I wouldn't, you know, it was, we lived.
It changed our lives.
Yeah, and we spent 2 years kind of pouring our lives and our passion and our dedication into this film, and we just hope people will appreciate it and see why we were doing it. That's all, you know.
So was it just two of you doing this? No, like proper crew? No.
No, we had tons of help and volunteers. And, I mean, mainly it was us two, but then we had some great shooters come
out.
We had
people who, you know, had a, like, we'd have to like bug people and be like, okay, it's like 4 a.m. on like on Friday, like can you come shoot this, or you know, like kind of ridiculous, and dragging some people through the downtown east side, like we had bricks thrown at the car, like all kinds of stupid stuff. And the guys that we had shooting would just be like, oh no, like not another day with Melissa and Kate.
Yeah,
that we got pulled over, like all kinds of stuff. But I mean, yeah, we did have help, but everyone who contributed to the project did it mostly out of volunteer.
Because they just loved it. And yeah. I should mention our editor, Lewis Lamb, yeah. who was locked in the editing room for hours upon hours every day.
With us.
We
guy.
Broke him.
But all those people contributed. But basically, the movie was, you know, me and Kate traipsing around the place, mm-hmm. you know. Just always trying to be there at the right time and developing friendships with people, so that, you know, I mean, it became more like we were part of this, like we were there because we cared about those people. So when you see us interviewing Malice, like chances are we would have been there anyways, you know. It was like you develop kind of a you and the story become, they turn to you when something happens in the story, and they want you to be there to follow it because they feel like that's maybe the only way in their desperation at that point that anyone will know about it, you know?
And we couldn't have done it without the people in the community who wanted to see the film made.
Yeah,
so,
exactly. So it's a lot about them.
Everyone contributed, and
Yeah, and like, you know, they would call us. So like, you know, if something happened and if Wendy got a complaint or if Malice did, well then we would get a phone call, and that's because that was their desire, was that this be expressed, that this be shown to people. We couldn't have done it without them wanting to be involved, you know?
Yeah.
So I saw on your website, nofuncity.org, that you can read about the movie on several major entertainment newspapers like Georgia Strait, Exclaim, and CBC Radio 3. Like the, were they excited to help you? Or was it like you can just pay the money and like we'll have your...
No.
And what was, they work in the entertainment industry. Do they see Vancouver as a fun city or no fun city?
Well, the McLean's thing was funny.
Yeah.
Because the McLean's reporter come to Vancouver for some story mm-hmm. and tried to go out and was really frustrated. And she said, like, the bars kept closing, or she'd go from one bar to the next, and they closed early, and she just couldn't really figure out where people were at and what the Granville Entertainment District was, and kind of went home, Googled No Fun City. She was like, yeah, Googled, like, why is it so boring here or something, and then found us, and then emailed us, and she did a full-page story about the Cobalt and about us before we'd even, before the film is even near completion. And that was because genuinely people find it interesting, especially in our generation too.
Yeah.
Like people, you know, it was often like younger reporters or people who kind of sympathize, and we didn't even send a press release, I don't think.
They all contacted us. So.
And from that demo, the demo that went out like last year, people were just like, wow, it's about time someone kind of looked at this.
Yeah, because when I think I saw it like about a year ago on Facebook, someone sent me the video. I was like, whoa.
Cool, thanks.
This is interesting, and I'm still interested. What actually happened with the movie. Okay, let's listen to a couple more songs, and I have more questions for you. And maybe we'll have some emails or maybe calls.
For a good time call.
Call us.
Been a long time coming, yeah, I've seen it all come and go. the heat's rising. It's gonna blow, the heat's rising. The heat's rising under pressure. It's gonna blow, the heat's rising. The heat's rising. It's gonna blow, the heat's rising. The heat's rising. It's gonna blow, the heat's rising. The heat's rising. It's gonna blow, the heat's rising. The heat's rising. It's gonna blow, the heat's rising. The heat's rising, rising, rising. It's gonna blow, the heat's rising. It's gonna blow.
CITR has more friends than ever before. We've partnered with tons of local businesses to bring you great discounts in the communities where you live, work, and play. Maybe Main Street is your main drag. Present your Friends of CITR card at Red Cat Records, Lucky's Comics, Devil May Wear, Thriller, Blim, Hotbox, The Kiss Store, The Wallflower Modern Diner, RX Comics, Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Vinyl Records, Regional Assembly of Text, and Twig and Hottie. to receive fabulous discounts. So become a CITR member, get a free friends card, and feel the love.
You listen to We All Fall Down on 101.9 CITR. We have several calls, like several number of calls here. So the first caller was Casey. She asked a question about how was the impact of the liquor licenses on closing down the venues. Because she said there's a certain number of liquor licenses that the city gives to the venue owners, and you need lots of money to get this...
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of becomes like a black market. The thing is, yeah, they're not...
Yeah, we should clarify that the city doesn't give people liquor licenses. Okay. There's a number of liquor licenses kind of floating around. Well, if... Okay, wait. And then people can privately sell liquor licenses to other people because there's a moratorium on... in most of Vancouver on new liquor licenses.
I think what it is basically, liquor licenses aren't issued how they are issued in another city, which is like you go there, you apply for one, it costs $1,000 or whatever, and you get one. There's a certain amount of liquor licenses that are already existing in Vancouver, and so you can't just apply for one. You have to get one of those that are already there. So if one place closes, they shift the liquor license to another place. Uh-huh. So it doesn't mean you have to buy that bar. It means that that number is a certain, like a fixed number. So what happens in that sense is that it increases the value of the liquor license. And that does have an impact in two ways on the venues. One is that a place like the Cobalt becomes much more desirable because it has a liquor primary. Mm-hmm. There's also this issue with all the different kinds of licenses and liquor licenses. A liquor primary is a place where you can sell booze all the time, like regular bar hours, and you know, that's what is so limited. Restaurants have different kinds of licenses, and then in the restaurants, they have different kinds of licenses, and so it becomes really complicated. But so that's how it impacts, I guess, why these clubs become something more valuable and why the Cobalt would be a place that someone would, you know, want to take over. In another city, maybe they wouldn't have, because they would probably maybe want a different kind of establishment, or, you know, they wouldn't be going after Skid Row hotels, basically. The other reason, though, is that, yeah, if you do want to buy one and you want to say, hi, like, I'm David Dupree, I want to open a bar and I want to buy a primary liquor establishment, it costs millions of dollars. Because there's so few of them, it's like a black market. Their value increases. Or like real estate here, it's like, it's kind of like the same kind of bubble. It's like, you know, because there's so little space here, and I don't know, people seem to want to live in these condos that are cost so much money, then the price of them becomes augmented. So what would need to happen is that the city would have to regulate them, and it would have to become like an ordinary town where you apply for one and you get one based on you, not based on whether or not that license exists to begin with. Also, in the downtown east side, it's different because there are no liquor licenses whatsoever, so you can't even apply for a liquor license in the downtown east side.
Okay, so that's... Okay, and the second caller was... Thank you. Thanks, everyone, for calling and just listening to our show. Thank you. The second caller was... he mentioned the Safe Amp organization.
Safe Amp, Safe Amplification Group. There are a bunch of people who started kind of lobbying City Hall. I know that they've had something to do with the regulatory review that's in place right now. So they've been kind of dealing with... I think they had roundtable talks where they were involved in trying to decide how we could open up more art spaces and all ages spaces is basically their big thing. And we think it's great. We try and include them in, you know, all our interviews. We always try and mention them. We've got them up on our website. It's a good resource. If you want to support them, support their shows, you can look up them up on their website, and they're doing a really great job.
Safeamp.org.
Thank you. The other thing, you talked lots to musicians. Yeah, to the band members.
Yep.
Different to the legendary, like, Subhumans and DOA, and to the younger musicians. What is their reaction? How do they see this city? Is it hard for them to get a local show to play? Or, like, do they care? Like, obviously, I think they do care, but...
It was interesting talking to, like, some of the older legendary musicians, like Joey Shithead and Ogre and Kevin Key from Skinny Puppy, because they were saying back in the day, like in the 80s, they kind of faced a similar thing to what's going on right now, where they played underground illegal venues. So that was really interesting.
I think not much has changed, and one of the reasons why I wanted to include, which was a huge honor for me, Skinny Puppy in the film, and as well DOA, well, Joe Shithead, is because they give you the perspective, and it's like the film Bloody But Unbowed that's in Doxa as well. It goes back to a time when Vancouver's scene kind of started. It's a very thriving scene, and it was at the same time still DIY, and it was under-supported, and nothing really has changed. And those people will look at us and kind of laugh, and they're like, wow, like, I didn't realize it was still going on, you know? Like, there's still a committed punk scene that still has the same issues. And so that was kind of cool, because it spans 30 years, you know? So that's why we wanted to include them. And then just listening to the stories, like, of Ogre and Kevin Key, and it's like, you know, they were homeless. They lived in the downtown east side. They made, you know, their music from basements and warehouses, and, you know, they weren't the most desirable, I guess, you know, kind of people, but not desirable, but, you know, they weren't, like, living the high glamorous rock and roll life, you know? They were down and out, but they were so passionate and so dedicated and so creative and so interesting, and this kind of translated and now has given Vancouver this, you know, this reputation for being a place where this awesome art comes out of. And so, you know, in that sense, yeah, that was really cool, like, looking back. And then also how, even though I don't think any of those bands influence the current scene, there's like tends to be like the same vibe, and it's that kind of that gritty kind of angry DIY culture that comes out of this like rainy town in the middle of nowhere. And it, you know, I think this Vancouver definitely has this sound, and we wanted to encapsulate that a little bit.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of 80s punk rock music, so I watched this documentary about American hardcore, and they talk a lot about this, and I read the book, and it says lots of they had to play some really weird places because it wasn't possible for them. And myself, I am from Russia, and I lived in 2 million city, and we had 2 rock clubs, so I came here for fun, and to me, like, you know, so I can see the both sides, like, I can see, so to me, it's still, like, I can see, I saw here lots of bands, lots of my favorite bands, and that's why I'm here. That's why I moved to Canada. So to me, it's, I don't know.
Yeah, well, we have more clubs than Siberia, for sure. But it doesn't mean that, you know, I think it's mostly just, I guess what I don't understand is, you know, it's such a small part of the city, and it is underrepresented, or not underrepresented. I mean, there are a few bands. It's not a massive local scene. It's not like anyone's trying to take the city over. And it seems like we get an awful lot of policing and an awful lot of, like, annoyance from the city and from police for no reason. Because really, I mean, what are we doing that's so wrong? And I think that's what I found kind of annoying, was when you see, like, an art gallery show with a band get busted. You're like, what are we doing here that, you know, means that you need to come all the way down here and make everyone go home? And why is it that that's such an issue? And, you know, maybe it's part of the image of this city. I'm not quite sure. But, you know, Joey Shithead would talk about, you know, when they were starting out, they would rent a hall, or they would, you know, play in the Japanese hall, or, you know, a church basement even. And he was like, you know, and then you'd only ever play once because they're never going to get you to come back, right?
Well, and that's what some of the noise bands in the film talk about too, like the Sex Negatives, that they'd maybe they'd play a legit venue and they'd start playing, and then all of a sudden their music would, or the power would turn off, and they'd be told never to come back. So then they started just being creative and kind of throwing shows in different places, like an underground parking garage or a warehouse. You know what I mean?
And that creativity is awesome.
Yeah.
And I think, like, it would suck if tomorrow, you know, all that was gone because everyone had their own venue in their backyard or whatever, but I don't think that's going to happen. And I think, basically, it's like the option isn't there.
You should, yeah, you should have the option for the alternative.
Yeah, you should have, you shouldn't be forced to have to play in a place like that. And Malice at the Sweatshop, he was forced to make his venue illegitimate because it wasn't, you know, everything that he tried to do wasn't accepted by the city, and no matter what he did, it still wasn't good enough. And in a case like that, it's like when you see that it isn't this, like, profound, you know, desire for DIY culture that's coming out, it's a frustration of trying to open a legitimate business and not being able to. So there's two different things. And I mean, you know, there's always going to be underground parties, and there's always going to be...
There always should be.
Yeah, but that's not really the point, you know? That was just, we included that culture because we think that's just a really good answer because you know what? It takes a lot of like stress and a lot of time and energy to do what Dave and Wendy and Malice do, and not that it doesn't to throw a party, but let's just say the payoff's a bit faster and everyone still goes out and sees the bands they want to see that night, you know?
Yeah. Okay, talking about the rickshaw.
Yeah.
There's a show coming up June 19th. That's a benefit show, Hardcore Needs Home.
Hardcore Needs a Home. Yeah, we'll be there. We're going to show the trailer.
Yeah.
But yeah, basically, Wendy, what does it say? Metal, punk, hardcore, noise. We will rise again. Wendy is throwing a show at the rickshaw. I know that the rickshaw, they're giving her the space for free, and all the bands are, it's all volunteer because we want Wendy to find a new place, so... She's all proceeds go to her and go to opening a new venue. I think they want to call it the Hellhole. details to be confirmed. We don't know where it is or what it's going to be, but I mean, everyone should come out. And yeah, if this is something that interests you, and you know, we say it all the time, you just got to be there, you know, because you can't do very much from like your home. You can't do very much. You got to be out there and supporting these bands and going to the shows.
Yeah, and exactly. If you like the music, that's your choice to show that you need more music.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
And you just have to come out and support music.
And you can get Wendy's autograph.
And one of the bands from the films will be playing there, Alcoholic White Trash.
Oh, yeah.
Along Not with genius. A lot of other great bands.
Yeah, I can see the lineup. It's Dead Jesus, Black Wizard, Uptown Riot, Alcoholic White Trash,
Malice Plague,
etc. Can't read the writing from here.
Yeah,
it's gonna be awesome.
It's gonna be good.
And I think the Skinny are a big part of it too. The Skinny magazine. So yeah, and I think it just shows that all these people want to help hardcore find a home. So we're gonna be there too.
Okay, so let's listen one more song and then we'll finish because it's almost we have still 10.
Time for bed. We gotta go.
Okay. Let's listen to some Isotopes, my favorite local band.
No sacrificing, no compromising, no jeopardizing. No sacrificing, no compromising. Compromising, no jeopardizing, no sacrificing, no compromising, no jeopardizing, no poison in the clubhouse, no poison in the clubhouse, no poison in the clubhouse. No poison in the, no poison in the, no poison in the, no poison in the, no poison in the clubhouse,
no poison in the,
no poison in the clubhouse,
no poison in the,
no poison in the clubhouse,
no poison in the,
no poison in the clubhouse.
You're listening to 101.9, We All Fall Down on CITR. We have a present for our listeners. there's the first show, the first screening is sold out. That's why that was the reason that Docs later the second screening on May 16th. And the first person who will call us will get a one last ticket.
Two. Yeah.
Two tickets. Even
you don't have
tickets.
To go alone. You can bring a date for the Sunday screening.
Sunday the 16th.
I think there's only 15 tickets left online, so, you know, come on, call us.
Oh, yeah, so the phone number is 604-822-2487. And, yeah, if you want to go to see this amazing movie, you have a chance, give us a call. And probably my last one of like last questions is what is the future of the movie? Are you planning releasing it on DVD? What do you see the future of the movie?
We want to tour with it. I mean, we'd like to take it across Canada, so that's something that we're trying to plan. Right now we just got it done, and you know, we do definitely want to have a DVD release. We're hoping this summer to have a big show, probably at the rickshaw, and you know, get a bunch of bands that were in the film, and then launch, you know, the DVD. I don't know, we're kind of just finishing it all up, so the details are unclear, but there definitely will be a chance for everyone to buy a copy of it at some point.
And there'll be another screening in the future for sure.
And it, like, when, you know, we want to have like a big fun event with all the bands that were in the film and just kind of, you know, celebrate all of that in one big event. I'm rambling.
Do you have any like approximate date for the show? Just like
this summer?
Summer, July.
Yeah.
We'll let you know, definitely.
Yeah.
And we'll come back. We'll talk about
sure. Yeah, if you like it.
We'll give away more tickets.
And I also saw on your website that you're planning to have some kind of petition on the website.
Well, we invited Gregor Robertson to the film.
The mayor?
Yeah. For those who don't know.
Yeah.
And yeah, you can read the letter up on our website. It's basically kind of a plea with him to just come and watch the film and see what can be done, not what can be done, but how this affects people, like on a human level. So we think maybe, you know, seeing the film and watching what everyone has to go through here and all the hoops that they have to jump through might help him change his mind or help city council, you know, decide to put all that that regulatory review into place. Because if you want, you can go on our website and you can read all about what has been planned for this year in city council and what they're reviewing, and it's a lot. And you know, we just hope that if they can come down and see how we're being affected, and you know, that those things will actually get done.
And just for him to even see the flourishing like music scene that exists here in Vancouver and how great of a community it is and how everyone just really cares and fights for for keeping
it
alive here.
You can just neglect, you know.
Yeah.
And I think the fact that the first screening was sold out like in days.
Yeah, it means it's important to people.
Exactly. Yeah, so it's not like, you know, we shot the movie and like a couple of people want to see it. No, there's a whole bunch of people really.
Yeah, and it's important. So, yeah, and basically because there is this year grace period, I guess, where they're reviewing a whole bunch of the laws that are making it difficult for art spaces, now is a really good time to be heard. So our film is coming out, and we hope that, you know, at least it draws attention to it. And we, you know, we're going to try and get a letter up on our website so that you can send it in to city council as well. And we really encourage people to speak up. And if you do want to keep these places or be able to one day own your own venue, or, you know, if you want your band to have better venues to play in or more options,
more
or
support.
If you want to support Wendy, or, you know, you need to do something about it and you need to speak up. They only hear from the other side. It's our turn, you know. Make some noise, people.
Okay, I think we're almost done.
No one's called in. My feelings are hurt.
Hey, people call. It's 604-822-2487. Or maybe they don't understand what I'm saying. 604-822-2487. Yeah, hopefully, yeah. Or you can maybe, yeah, call. We have a couple minutes left.
Come get those tickets, people. Well, if not, you know, I'm sure they'll find a home.
Yeah.
Or you know what? Maybe you can have them, Tim.
Oh, so don't call. Okay, thank you so much, girls. Melissa and Kate, the creators of the No Fun City movie, they're here. And so the first sold-out premiere is May 10th, Doxa Festival, and the second is May 16th, also Doxa Festival.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming in. It was really a pleasure for me, and thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
ATR has more friends than ever before. We've partnered with tons of local businesses to bring you great discounts in the communities where you live, work, and play. Maybe Main Street is your main drag. Present your Friends of CITR card at Red Cat Records, Lucky's Comics, Devil May Wear, Thriller, Blim, Hotbox, The Kiss Store, The Wallflower Modern Diner, RX Comics, Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Vinyl Records, Regional Assembly of Text, and Twig and Hottie to receive fabulous discounts. So become a CITR member, get a free Friends card, and feel the love.
This is Inkstead, CITR 101.9 FM. My guest today is...